to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
All right, people, our next guest here at Guitar Radio Show is a gentleman who has been making guitars for over 40 years. Am I right? 40 years? 40 years.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
45 now.
45 years. And he's made guitars for the likes of Clapton, Townsend, Gilmore, and the list goes on and on beyond that. He has worked and one of the founding members of the Fender Custom Shop back in 87, and he was also an R&D in R&D leadership at Fender for many, many years as well. But he makes his own guitars, and has been for a while now, and they are quite lovely, and I have lots of questions about those. We have Mr. John Page. How are you, John? Welcome to Guitar Radio Show.
I'm doing peachy, Mark. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Hi to everybody out there.
Yeah. Folks, you can go to johnpageguitars.com to check out the website. It's a really cool website, and there's a lot going on there, and I've got tons of questions. So the first thing I want to say to you is I recently got to play an AJ, and I about lost my mind. I was like, oh, my Lord, what a great guitar. What a great guitar.
Very cool.
And I'm a lefty, so I flipped it over sort of like Eric Gales does with your with your Ashburn. And it was actually, you know, I had seen Eric playing your guitars, and I was like, huh, check that out, John Page, oh man. So, you know, that made me really go and start to look, and that was about 2 years ago, I guess, or so, maybe more. How long has Eric been playing your guitars?
He's actually started playing one as soon as we started the production line, which was just about 2 years ago.
Yeah, so that's...
He was one of the first cats that came along and played it.
Yeah.
Which is cool, because, I mean, I worked with him years and years ago at Fender, and so, and I didn't ask him to be involved, actually. My partner Howard did, and Howard had known him for quite a few years, so it was kind of like old home week, you know, to see him playing again with one of the guitars I built.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. But that, yeah, so going back...
You know, we...
Go ahead.
You mentioned your lefty. We do lefties now. Just not an AJ. Right now, you know, we're doing a classic version of the Ashburn and lefty.
Really?
We just released that in January.
Wow, that's cool. And is there an upcharge on that or no?
No.
That's...
Well, you know what? I'm speaking out my brain without... having the prices in front of me. I could be wrong there. On my customs, I never charge more for lefties. I mean, you know, they're hand-built. It's the same amount of work. On the production ones, I'm not sure if that's exactly the case, so you may have to check that.
Okay. I'll look it up.
Sorry about that.
But yeah, so that AJ, man, I tell you, upside down, you know, and I can do what Eric does as far as playing it Albert King style with the bass strings at the bottom. But... that guitar, it just... let me ask you this. Am I crazy? But I've always found that I can sit with an electric guitar that's not plugged in. I've never heard it through an amp. But if it sounds really good acoustically, just in my hands and resonating against my body, for the most part, I've noticed that every time I plug it in, then it's a great guitar. And that's what I found with the AJ.
First off, I'm thrilled that you know, you felt that way, but I got to tell you, that's my whole design mantra, basically. You know, every guitar I design is designed to sound good acoustically. That's my camp, you know what I mean? I mean, that's what I believe in. I believe an electric guitar is an acoustic instrument first, and the pickups are microphones, you know, and you can vary those microphones to get different sounds out of that voice, but that voice is still the key. So to me, it's like a singer. You know, if you got a really good voice and you put them in front of a good or bad microphone, they're still going to have a really good voice. They're just going to sound better or worse depending on the mic and the PA system, right?
Yeah.
It's the same thing to me with an electric guitar. So a lot of that a lot of that tone comes not only from the material selections, because material selections are pretty traditional, but it's my neck joint system. You know, putting in the threaded inserts into the neck, with the oversized machine bolt, that tonal coupling really aids that, you know, that overall acoustic voice. So
right, so you're creating more mass. You're creating more mass at the joint.
Well, yeah, and you're actually just that coupling, you know what I mean? It's I still, you know, I look at guitars as a recipe, you know, so it's still really important what that, you know, what that neck material is made of and the fretboard and that body. And then when you, the better you can join those two together, you know, the more you're going to get that whole instrument to speak as a united voice, as opposed to a bunch of different materials, you know, finding each other to actually work in unison.
Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting too, when I look at other, I've been a Fender devotee for a long, long time, but before that, I was really into Gibsons and stuff. But then I would see how some dovetail joints are created, and sometimes when there's a dovetail joint, there's a gap between the lip of the joint as it goes into the socket, if you will. And sometimes there's a gap there, and I'm like, well, why would you leave a gap there?
Well, and that's where you don't want that gap. I mean, the contact of the front of the neck to the body is one of the most important contact points in the entire instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I mean, even if you have a Fender style guitar, right, and you don't know if it's actually got its full tonal capabilities. While it's strung up, you can just loosen each screw like a quarter to a half a turn, and lots of times that neck will, you know, snap forward. It will click, you'll hear a clunk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you tighten it back up, and you can increase the tonal, you know, like I said, the capacity of your instrument by like 15-20%. It can make your guitar sound so much better, and it's just the fact that the front of that neck joint is contacting the pocket properly.
Hmm. Okay.
So when you look at a dovetail joint or a Morrison tenon joint, and it's missing that, you know, it's missing that front contact because there's a gap there, to me, that's a total loss of tonal transfer.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean squat about what's happening on the sides.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of the sound waves traveling through that neck, they're not gonna go sideways, you know what I mean?
Right.
They wanna go straight down that body pocket,
right? So
and into the you know, into the bridge section,
right? So it's like interrupting current.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, interesting. You were talking about materials before, how important materials are for you. Do you have a favorite tone wood?
Actually, you know, that it's interesting because that kind of changes. You know, sometimes it'll change from year to year, or, you know, I'll find my new favorite tone wood, you know, and then I'll be, that's like my best buddy for a few years, and then I'll find something else. I have a couple, actually, that I've been really, really into for the last probably 6 to 8 years, at least in my one-offs, and that's Black Limba. I love, you know, the Limba family, white or black. And then Corn Orchard Cedar is another one of my favorites lately. So what I've been, like, in my one-offs, very heavily have done a lot of, like, Limba Core, Corn Orchard Winged body sandwiches. And it's amazing because the Limba, you get this beautiful chesty mid, nice bottom out of it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Corn Orchard, it's like a speaker cone. It makes it louder. It gives a really nice top end to it, and it helps it sting.
Mm-hmm.
So the combination of those two woods for me has become, you know, like I said, something I do a lot of. And then I'll dress that up with, you know, different tops. Right now, I think I have at least two in process like that. One with a quilted maple little top, one with a koa top, and that combo just sings lovely.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, it's interesting that you say that, you know, you get into certain ones and you say, well, this is my favorite right now, and this is what's really, it's resonating with you, you know, literally and figuratively. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you go around like that and change. And I hear, you know, I hear so many players say, you know, like me, I'm a big fan of playing on a rosewood fretboard. And because most of the maple board that I've ever played on were usually too polished for, you know, initially. And I was like, well, I don't have time to be wearing this thing down.
So it was more of a feel thing to you?
Yeah, it was a feel thing. Yeah, I think. Uh-huh. But for some reason, yeah, I do like, notice a difference between the sound of rosewood and maple.
Yeah, I notice an absolute difference between the two tonally.
Yeah.
There's definitely a feel thing, mm-hmm. you know, and then you obviously have the third aesthetic thing. When I was gigging out, I liked the look of a maple fretboard, so I always played a maple fretboard.
Mm-hmm.
And feel wasn't so much of an issue because I really suck at playing. I mean, I was a lead singer, so, you know, it was kind of like a decoration, and I would mute the E&A string and chunk away for 3 hours, you know, and that's kind of what I did. But, you know, as a builder, I can hear the absolute tonal differences when I'm building.
Right.
But that's also because I'm in a very controlled environment. So I think lots of times the cats that, you know, where they're like tone hounds in a studio and they're one-on-one with their instruments and will hear the difference more than someone who's playing with the band. I think the nuance of that tonal difference is lost, you know, once a bass player comes in or a set of drums or, mm-hmm. you know, or the first pedal, you know, then I think that nuance kind of goes away, other than feel and aesthetic.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting.
And when we talk about materials, too, I mean, I would go back to my core favorites, which, like on the classics, or alder body, maple neck, rosewood fretboard. That's probably my favorite mm-hmm. as a classic, because alder has such a nice, you know, kind of tonal reproduction across the whole spectrum of high, mediums, and lows.
Right.
So it's got a real nice, you know, straight line going there. So where ass, I love the looks of ass better. I hate the fact that it cuts the mids a lot. So, you know, like the AJ you played was. I don't know if it was an ash or alder, but chances are alder because standard it comes with the alder body.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then with that reverse pickup, lead pickup, you get a lot more thickness to that instrument as opposed to, you know, getting those ice pick highs and losing that the mids that I'm looking at.
Yeah, for sure. It was real. It was real. It still had that, you know, that T-style spank, you know, but what really did it for me was that PAF, P90 in the neck. Holy cow. I got to tell you, that is...
You like that, huh?
Holy cow, man. That is the best P90 I have ever heard. Ever. It is, and you know, it's crazy. Folks, if you go to johnpageguitars.com, folks, you can buy these pickups on their own. And they are so reasonably priced too. Like that P90 is only $75.
Yeah.
Incredible. So what?
Well,
you know, I'm not asking you for a recipe or anything, but what did you do different with this pickup?
Well, but you know what I've tried to do with all the pickups, because I voiced these pickups. I don't physically make them, but I voiced them. So I worked with the builder of the actual maker of the pickups. Told him what I wanted as far as material and wire, and my suggestions of what I was looking for as far as tone, and went back and forth with him until, you know, we got that tone. As far as the P90, when I was looking, I love peanuts. I absolutely love them, but they're usually too thick and muddy, and I didn't want that.
And noisy,
too. You know, basically, yeah, and so... Well, you know, the noise factor for me, we were able to deal with it just in the shielding of the instrument, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know, I just basically, you know, underwound a little bit is all we did on that P90.
Huh.
And then voiced it to match the you know, the tele bridge so that we get a nice balance there.
It's such a...
You know, it's the same with
so good.
One thing I should mention, just when you say, when you go to johntateguitars.com, you have the option to go to John, either my customs or the production ones.
Right.
The production ones are the classics.
Right.
So that's actually johntageclassic.com. But you can, if you go to John Page Guitars, you can still choose which path to take.
Right.
And so if you're looking for that P90, that would be under the John Page Classic end.
Right.
Just want to clarify that.
For sure. And folks, when you go to the show notes at guitarradioshow.com, you'll be able to find a link that'll directly lead you to that. So that'll be sitting there along with some video. I found a really great video of a guy who's been on the show and is a friend of the show, Mr. Greg Calk, who did a I guess for Wildwood, I think it was for, did a video of the AJ, and he's just tearing it up on there, man. That thing sounds so good.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. So have you seen that video?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, that's a good
one. Yeah, I have seen it.
That's a good one.
And, you know, I watched Greg play my guitar several times, and he just, you know, he tears it up.
He's a fun guy. He really does. So you named your two of your main models after your children.
Yes.
One is the Ashburn, and the other is the AJ.
Yeah, all my guitars I name after loved ones. That's my thing.
That's super cool. I like that. You built your first guitar at 15, was it?
Yeah.
What was
it? Yeah, I was a kid in a you know, single income, lower middle class family who wanted to, you know, play music and write music primarily, and you know, couldn't afford anything. So I started like buying really, really crappy guitars at pawn shops and modifying them because I wanted to look cooler and be better guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually before 15. And then 15, I actually, you know, got a piece of wood and started building away.
And what was the, I mean, so nobody taught you? You just taught yourself?
Yeah. I have a bad habit of doing that in my life. I don't take instruction well.
I don't think that's
easier to do it myself.
I don't think that's such a bad habit, John. I really don't. I think I don't know. I it's something that I can't wrap my head around because I've never done that. I mean, I would, you know, you futz around maybe with the guitar that, you know, but I would never think to myself, okay, I'm going to take these three guitars and make one good one out of it, and then from there say, well, you know what, I can do better than this. I'm going to build my own thing. It's just amazing.
That's how my brain works. I mean, before guitars, doing that, I was doing that with models. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. like car models.
Mm-hmm.
Like again, we didn't have much money, right? So if I was lucky enough to get a guitar or a little plastic car model. And then it's like, okay, I'm bored of this. Then I would cut it in half, and I would, you know, do something else with it and glue something else on it. And you know what I mean? It was always my way of, that's how my brain just is wired. Again. So I would do that with everything I ever had. And then when I got into guitars, it was just like a natural evolution. By the way, I built my own house and shop, too, that I live in.
Really?
And I wasn't taught that either. I bought a book, How to Build a House, and I built it. So it's the same kind of deal with guitars. When I was young, there was only one book that I could find out there on building guitars, and it was by Irving Sloan, and it was like How to Build a Classical Guitar. And I don't know when he actually wrote that, but that was like the only book out there, and it was how to build a classical instrument. It had nothing to do with electric. But it gave me enough information for me to be able to, you know, then, you know, interpret that and transfer it to how I could build, you know, a electric guitar.
Wow.
I never took woodshop either, except for seventh grade where you had to take a half a semester. That was the only woodshop I ever took. So, yeah, I don't know why I do what I do. It's weird.
It's pretty cool.
It worked out well.
Yeah, it did work out well. And didn't just work out well for you. It worked out well for a lot of people who got was on the receiving end of your instruments, so that's great. And continue to
It feels really good. It's great to know how many people out there, you know, have played guitars that designed or built, or, you know, it's fun to run into them, you know, years later and see the guitar and see it holding up, or how well it's aged, or, you know, it's fun to see some of these clubs, like the Bullets Owners Club and stuff, you know, and it's like, that was my first design at Fender. And it's great to see that guitar coming back over the last, you know, half a dozen years as being kind of a cool, wacky collectible, and how many Bullet Owners are out there, or Performer Bass Owners, or, you know, it's kind of fun to look back on that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, and it's hard. It's hard to introduce. You know, that Fender culture is really very staunch in regards to accepting anything new coming into the fold. You know, as far as a new design.
Oh yeah, I experienced that firsthand. I know that very well. Yeah.
So what was that like when you brought the design in? You're like, okay, I got this. What do you think? Was it?
Well, the bullet one was, it wasn't really that much of an issue. It was my first patent, which was cool. The bridge pick guard combo was my first patent. Greg Wilson, who was also a designer before me, so we worked on that one together. But it was still a pretty traditional Fender, right?
Right.
With the exception of that one piece. When it came to things like the Performer, that was completely different, because a lot of people don't know this, but that was actually, when I designed that, that was supposed to be the Elite Jazz Bass. That was going to actually replace the Jazz Bass. And so in that project sequence, once we had developed the Vintage Series, right, which was, you know, the reissue Vintage Series, the 52 Tele and the 57 Strat and the 62 Strat, the P and Jazz that we were building at the time, I can't remember, 57 B bass and 61 Jazz, 62 Jazz, maybe 62. Once we had designed that, then we created the standard series of Fenders, and those were the cheap and down version. Remember, that was the Strat with the volume tone with the jack and the pick guard.
Yeah.
Really simple tremolo bridge. I mean, they bombed terribly, but I mean, the idea was, okay, we have the Vintage now, there's tradition. Now let's do a cheaper version, there's the standards. Now the Elites could go as crazy and wild as we wanted to go. This was the marketing thinking behind that. And so working with Dan Smith on that, that's when we created the Elite Tele and the Elite Strat and active pickups and, you know, all the kind of stuff that went on with the Elites, which also eventually bombed. But that allowed, so then the Jazz Bass could go wherever, just like the Tele did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at that point, so many guitar players were switching to bass that my thinking was, you know, okay, let's make that neck even narrower, go all the way up, you know, let's get a little wacky with the body. And so, it was accepted by marketing, but then at the end it was like, okay, maybe we'll get, you know, crucified for this one. Maybe we shouldn't take the Jazz Bass to that extreme. And so that kind of got shelved and then released later as as the Performance, completely separate instruments.
That's wild. And I still see them.
Yeah.
I still see them. And they're sought after, which is...
Yeah, they're weird. You know, I would definitely do things differently today, but it was really cool. I mean, it was, in fact, I think I'm the only guy who's ever designed a new Fender logo that was in production for, you know, since the 60s, too, because that Fender logo was real spiky for the Performer and everything else, and, you know,
and that was the time.
Somebody told me one day.
That was the time, then. It was just, it was kind of a cultural thing at that time.
I mean, it was the 80s. It was like, you know, early 80s.
Everything was pointy.
Hair and,
yeah, everything was pointy.
I was right there with my corporate mohawk, so it was all good.
Oh, man. So, you know, I was looking at your bio and your on your website, and there's a cool thing in there about you and Freddie Tavares.
Mm-hmm.
And so that must have been an interesting thing for you in regards to, well, here's somebody taking you kind of in under their wing, and you must have learned a lot, I imagine.
Well, I did. But, you know, the weird thing about it, though, I have to say, is that I never really knew the history of Fender. You know, when mm-hmm. I started at Fender, it wasn't like I knew who Freddie was at the time.
Uh-huh. He was a cat who worked there.
You know, I found out, he just happened to work there. But once I started working there, then I knew who he was. But, he really, really became like my dad. So, you know, we were so close. And so much of the mentoring that I got from Freddie wasn't necessarily instrument related, you know, as much as it was just kind of like human related, kindness, the way he treated people, you know, his energy level, the way he looked at life. Those were some of the biggest lessons I learned from him. But the stories were amazing as well. You know, like when he told me the first day he actually started working for Leo, you know, as a regular gig, as opposed to being a guy that, you know, they would bring instruments to or he'd come in every now and then. But when he actually started working for him, he said he went out the shop and, you know, he cut this piece of wood, and I don't know what plywood or what, but, and then he said he sanded it to, you know, make sure all the grain was completely out of it, and then he tacked a piece of paper to it, and he drew two lines, and that was the bridge, and that was the intonation point, the bridge and the nut of what would be the Stratocaster. And it was actually a piece of butcher paper, basically tacked to a piece of plywood, and that was his first day. So, and then when I would talk about the development of Strat with him, he said, you know, he would never, ever get off of the same statement, which was, Leo had to approve every line I did. So as far as I'm concerned, Leo designed it. And that always impressed me because I know as a designer how much is involved of that person with the pencil, you mm-hmm. know, at the table. I know how much he had to put into that, and yet he always said Leo had to prove everything, so Leo did it. But I know from working with him how much he did have to do with that, you know. But, you know, you learn that kind of humility from him, and I did learn a lot. I mean, the same that, you know, I didn't have any drafting experience or engineering experience either, you know. So I learned a lot of that from Freddie, and I really had no business having that gig, but I'm so glad that Fender took a chance with me on that.
Well, I guess it was one of those, you had to fly. You had to perform, and it probably challenged you in a way that you hadn't been challenged before, and you stepped up. You were able to do it.
Yeah, and it was a thrill for me. I mean, it was like the coolest thing in the world. I mean, I got hired at Fender on my 21st birthday. And I actually had started applying there at 16. I quit school and I was looking for a job, and I went to Fender and they wouldn't hire me. And a year later, I ended up going back to school, finishing school, everything else. But I got hired on my 21st birthday. So I'm a kid, and I'm working with all these greats. Even though I didn't know who they were at the time, and it was just like working with Harold Rhodes and Trey Tavares and Ed Johns, who, you know, was one of the guys that developed the freaking FM radio, and he was the camp designer. You know, all these cats are like incredibly historic cats. What a thrill, you know.
Yeah, that's wild. So one thing I'm always interested in when somebody is like yourself, who designs guitars and then also has to build a guitar for an artist. So if an artist comes to you and they have certain spec, or they want to sort of like, you know, like with Clapton, you know, reproducing an instrument or whatever, how much of a conversation is going on with you and the artist to get to the end goal?
That really, really, really depends on the artist.
Yeah.
You know, there are artists like couple of lefties I'll throw out, Cesar Rosas or Elliot Easton, that would come out to the shop and hang out. And we would, you know, go over it and over it and over it, and even handshake necks and hand them back and forth and stuff like that, right? To where they are heavily involved in the development of the guitar. And then there's guys like Eric, where we were constantly going through Lee Dixon, you know, his tech. So with very little input from Eric personally. In fact, I mean, I'm trying to think, like, you know, at one point meeting one of these weird business travel stories. I think I was in Vienna and I had to fly back to, supposed to come home, and then they said, no, Eric wants to meet us, so fly to New York instead. So I flew to New York to meet with Eric. And he said, well, I want to get more involved with my guitars. And this is after we had been building his guitars for 6 or 7 years. You know what I mean? You know, it all depends on, like I said, on the artist. And the Eric Clapton guitar went through so many different guys. I mean, when I had left Fender in 86, they started the Clapton signature piece. So that was Dan Smith and George Blanda working very closely with Lee and trying to work there to develop the first prototypes. And then when Mike Stevens and I came on and started the custom shop, then, you know, he and I started working with him on it. But again, it was almost always Lee. And then I know Michael got really frustrated at one point, said, forget it, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. And then I think we finally got Blackie in. And so we could, you know, nail the neck, because no matter what we did, Eric wasn't happy for the longest time. But we're going by, you know, descriptions, and as opposed to having the artist there or, you know, the instrument that he fell in love with. Then once you got Blackie in-house, then you could do the better, and then it was, you know.
Right.
Then you could nail it.
Right. And that's all about measurements and photos and everything else.
Yeah, so much of that. Yeah, and there's so much that, you know, you try to measure, like, for instance, on a neck, especially one that's been older, you know, that's older, trying to get that edge roll over just right, for instance. Or some of these older necks, I mean, you know, I sit here now with, you know, I hand-shape every neck that, you know, my one-offs. I mean, they're rasps and files and scrapers. And I have a couple of profile gauges. I have the profile of what I want that shape to be at the 12th, what I want that shape to be at the 1st, and then I use, you know, as I'm filing, I use a straight edge to make sure everything's lined perfectly. You know, I mean, it's a pain in the butt, right? And yet, that's not how they were done, you know, 50 years ago. The thing came off a shaper, and the guys just sanded the crap out of them. So they might have a belly to them. They might be thicker in the middle than at the 12th, or, you know, they could be all over the place. So unless you have that neck in front of you, if it's a guy's favorite neck, you don't know how that neck is really shaped. And so that's what's hard to mimic without having the piece right in your hands and then being able to check it everywhere and make it work.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. So this year, I know was it 30th anniversary for the custom shop?
30th anniversary is under custom shop.
Yeah, and they brought a bunch of folks back and got people to come in and do one. And you did the Pajo Caster.
Yeah, I did. Andre Duchossois, who was a writer of one of the Stratocaster books and the Telecaster book, and he actually dubbed it that years ago. I think 89 or 90 when I made the first one. And it's a double FO Esquire. And the first ones I built were the Fairclough Spruce, Mahogany Bat, Multiple Bound, Esquire.
Right.
And I built one for him. He goes, oh, it's a Page of Caster. And he put it in his telly book, I think. And, I thought that, I always liked that guitar. But, you know, I'm not a big fan of Esquires per se. But I thought, with all the things I've been doing over the years, I figured I could get to where I could make it and like it even more. And so that's what I did with this one, you know, with the use of my wood tone saddles, which are the ebony stainless steel saddles I make here in my custom shop. Putting those on the bridge allowed me to take that ice pick out of it, overwinding that Esquire pick a little bit, actually underlined it for an Esquire, but I mean overlined it for a Telly first pickup. And the way I've, you know, resculpted my acoustic chambers now on the guitar, I was really happy with the way it turned out. It's a pretty cool axe.
Yeah, it's cool. It's beautiful to look at, too.
Yeah, it's real pretty, and the koa was my little nod to Freddy, you know, because it's a Hawaiian wood, and
sure.
I thought that would be a really nice way to keep his spirit alive in my design. So.
Sure, yeah. What's your impression on this whole thing with the sites law with rosewood and everything else? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, you know, my root opinion is that anytime there's we're in danger of destroying something beautiful on this planet, I'm all for trying to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the fact that the rainforests are getting shredded the way they are. Mm-hmm. I understand the thought behind protecting and limiting that wood. Unfortunately, I don't think it's the impact that things like, you know, ripping the forest out to raise cattle are, as opposed to fretboards on guitars.
Yeah.
It's a pain in the butt for the, all the regulation and, I haven't even got my permits yet. I got to because I have orders that I have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Like so many things, they start off with a great idea and maybe, go too far. Mm-hmm. I think what they're doing for players, having to take product across borders and stuff, that's just...
It's totally weird.
The instrument that gets kind of stupid, yeah. But, there's a lot of great woods there that aren't protected. And the one thing I have noticed is I don't experiment as much as I should because there's woods I love. So when you, all of a sudden, when you say, okay, you can't use this now, you tend to experiment more, mm-hmm. which is good.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that cord orford cedar, which I love to death. It's mm-hmm. sustainable as heck. But it's a body wood, not a fretboard, but, still. It's a pain in the butt, I'll say that. But I'm not going to say bad things about it because, like I said, anything that protects what we do is great. See, the drag is this. Builders like me as a one-off guy, we're not really hurting that. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So if you have Saul Cole and me and John Sir and, guys that are building, 20, 30, 50, couple hundred guitars a year, we're not the guys screwing it up. But when you have companies using that species that make hundreds of thousands of guitars per year, then mm-hmm. you have to look at, okay, that usage is serious, and people tend to forget that, Fender makes half a million guitars a year. Gibson made hundreds of thousands of guitars a year.
Mm-hmm.
Ibanez. You stack up all these companies, and you have got, I don't know the numbers, but how many guitars have been made?
Probably more guitars than there are players.
Oh, absolutely. Without question, there are. That's why everybody's got 20, 30 guitars. how many guitar players do you know that has one guitar?
Not many.
Right? So, yeah.
So, with your customs, are you still doing somewhere around 12 to 15 a year? Is that about your average?
Yeah. It's not only just the process. I like to, build slowly, my process requires tons of different cure times at different, at different points throughout the building cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm always designing. I'm always have new projects going. So it's a kind of deal where that's the maximum I can get out. And it's a drag. I wish I could make more, but that really is, that seems to be my peak.
Yeah. And that's
better than that.
And that's just you, nobody helping you, right?
Right. Yeah, my wife works with me on making the wood tone saddles. Uh-huh. So she does that with me and machines the bridge plates and stuff like that. But as far as actually working on the guitars, no, it's just me. No apprentices. I've brought in a couple over the years, and they moved on, and it was disappointing. And so I don't know. I'm always open to another apprentice, but...
Yeah. It's interesting, you know...
When it happens...
Yeah, you'll know it. It'll be right.
Yeah,
exactly. For sure. I can dig it. So you know, it's going back to the classic series. I was thinking about it the other day after really just looking at them and then playing that AJ, and it's interesting that for a guitar that's about $1,500, it's like getting a hot rodded guitar already. So you're off the right out of the box. It's already hot rodded. Was that kind of your mentality for the instrument?
Absolutely, and I think that, my partner calls it a custom production guitar. That was it. To me, what it was, well, first off, my lines are completely different. This is my version of the Stratocaster that I always, designed for Fender, or the Telecaster I always designed for Fender. Mm-hmm. It was my vision of how I would change those instruments. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to prove to myself too that some of the nuances that I do in a custom hand build could make serious impact on a production guitar of a high quality made production guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that, I believe that to be true. I believe my, my neck joint, my reverse angle pickup, the slightly modified, pickup, again, just nuanced voicing of pickups, do indeed do that. Give you a nice hot rodded guitar at a production guitar price.
Mm-hmm.
That was the goal. I mean, that was absolutely the goal going into it.
Yeah, that was a feeling I've got when I'm holding the instrument, I'm playing the instrument, I was like, this thing's already hot rodded. Because a lot of times, like if I get a Strat, and I've got way too many Strats, if I've got a Strat and I get it in front of me and it's stock, immediately I'm going, okay, what do I got to do to get this to where I need it to be? And that's not what I felt when I was playing your guitar. I was like, oh, this guitar is already where it needs to be.
Yeah, and that was the goal, but then I also know that it's not totally realistic, because that's the one cool thing with a quote-unquote Fender-style product, is that hot rodding is still going to be there in the nature. So, I almost immediately started making replacement pick darts for them and stuff like that I offer. It's when you do a production guitar, you're trying to keep the cost down,
mm-hmm.
you do things. You have to make decisions, for instance. Even color, okay, well, this color would look better with this pick guard, but because I got four colors in that production model, I got to go with one pick guard kind of deal, right? So, I do that just because, I know how cool a shell pick guard's going to look on something. Or a gold anodized, aluminum pick guard, how great that's going to look on something.
Yeah.
And I can't afford to do that on a production piece. But somebody, wants one, I make them. And then that way they can still customize their classic.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is one of the wonderful things too. Is when you do like those type of things, the aesthetic customization of it all is always interesting because it does make the guitar even more unique. But I was coming more from the standpoint of when I was playing that AJ, I was like, with this, I can destroy the world with this P90 pickup. I can do whatever I want to do.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, that was, like I said, that was the premise of the whole thing. It's like, okay, I've built custom guitars for 30 years,
plus, right?
But I mean, just from the start of the custom shop, I built 30 years of custom Fender-style guitars. What's my favorite out of that? What was my goal out of all that? And that's what these guitars represent to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did it. What's your collection like?
My collection is actually relatively small. I sold a lot of the instruments I had over the last, say, 20 years, and I gave my kids guitars when I left Southern California. I gave my kids guitars, but I said, okay, here, I'm going to give you this. This is the last one, probably until I die. So, you know, enjoy. Right now, I don't, you know, most of the guitars I have, I'm trying to think. I've got some cool old Fenders. I've got, you know, we used to have the a policy that started long before I started there, Freddie, where, you know, when guys would design guitars, then they would get a prototype of that design. And so I have some cool prototypes of custom guitars we had. I've got a Harley Davidson prototype, chrome, and then a really cool one. It's all 23 karat gold Harley, which is pretty neat. I have I got a guitar. I got a story for you. Okay, you want it? If you want a cool story,
I love cool stories.
One of the guitars in my collection. Okay, so there's two parts to the story. All right.
Okay.
The first part of the story is Jay Black, who is, you know, one of my master builders at the custom shop, called up Pamelina Hobnitanian, who was our graphic artist, and because Jay had a customer who wanted to have a painted F-hole on a guitar. A violin F.
Right.
So he called up Pamelina and said, "Hey, Pamelina, I need an F-hole painted on a guitar. I'm going to send you a scrap body." And she goes, "Oh, okay, fine." And then she hangs up, and then she calls me, and she said, "John," she goes, "I got the weirdest call from Jay Black." And I said, "What?" She goes, "He called me up, and he said, John, Pamelina, I need you to paint an asshole on a guitar." and I start laughing. I go, no, Pamelina. F-hole, not asshole. You know, F-hole, like the violin. Oh. And so we both get a good chuckle out of it. And I go, "You know what? I'm going to send you another Strat body, okay? And I want you to paint an asshole on it. In fact, paint a bunch of assholes." So Pamelina paints the Strat body with, I don't know, a dozen or so of the most graphic, vivid, hairy, puckered, hemorrhoid-ridden assholes that you've ever seen in your life.
That's great.
And sends that body to Jay Black. So Jay gets the body. We all got a great big laugh. Okay, end of story one. Okay, that's the first part of the story.
Right.
Now, just about the same time, Chris Robinson and the Black Crowes does an interview in one of the guitar magazines, and they're asking about his gear, and he was dealing with whoever Artist Loration's director was at the time, and who was his artist builder, whose names I won't get into, but and he's talking about the guitars and how much he really likes the guitars, but he goes, "But dealing with those assholes, you know." So he really didn't like his interaction with the guys he was dealing with in our shop. So I said, "You know, I got this body. We're all going to sign a butthole, and we're going to send this guitar to Chris Robinson, and we're going to save him all the assholes on the custom shop." And I thought it was like the best thing in the world, right? I thought this would be the coolest thing. I knew he would get a kick out of it. You know, we would feel vindicated just because, you know, whatever. And but the artist relations director wouldn't do it because he said no. He did. He had no sense of humor, this guy. And so anyway, I have that guitar. So I have it's a strap with buttholes painted all over it and a bunch of signatures of all of those guys that run the shop at the time.
Has anyone ever seen the light of day of that guitar, like pictures? Are there pictures on the web anywhere with that?
No. That's one that's just kind of, that's one for the private archives.
Boy,
such time as I decided to let that one go.
I'd love to get a gander of that, man. That's great.
The drag is, I had that body, you know, my entire career at Fender, the whole time at the custom shop, but I never even, the guitar was never finished out. So it was the body with just buttholes painted all of it and our signatures, right? And it was just in a cotton bag and in my office for years and years and years. And so finally, when I left, Art Esparza, who was one of our builders, you know, I asked him if he'd just finish it out for me. And so we had them paint it and stuff, but I guess they were afraid that maybe the people that would see it, if it got buffed and stuff, so it never got buffed or anything. Uh-huh. So it was like dirty under the paint. It's kind of like, you know, rust.
Right.
But it's just a great story.
What a great, yeah, that's a conversation piece.
Yeah. Oh, it's a cool piece.
That's
and
great.
Then, I have the first Calacoustic I designed and built that I had out with, that I actually loaned to John Bon Jovi on the Blaze of Glory tour. I remember loaning that to him, and I got that one back. And when I retired from Fender, they gave me a really beautiful Pagecaster out of flame maple with my name engraved on, or inlaid in abalone and stuff on it. I don't know, you know, just, and then a bunch of my guitars, prototypes of, you know, my classics and are all over the place. And, oh, and my old piece of crap, actually the neck plate says John Page's piece of shit telly. I had broken my arm when Freddie and I were still working together. Freddie was working on the very first finished reissue, was the 52 Tele.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working on that design, and I had broken my arm. And I was still, I had a bunch of gigs to play, I had like 14 gigs to play, and had this beautiful Blake Classen Tele that I wasn't going to play out with this cast because I knew I would damage the guitar. So I just took terrible white blonde polyester like 8-pound ash body and built out a telly all out of prototype 52 telly parts, and I still have that. It's the biggest piece of crap in the world, but it's my favorite guitar because, you know, it took me through a lot of my life. So
yeah, that's super cool.
Yeah,
that is super cool. I can't let you go without asking you, what is functional art furniture?
Well, I actually think if you go to my website, I believe there's a link on that where you can actually look at some of it. But basically, functional art furniture is it's functional because it's furniture, and it's art because that's how I approached it. So it's very wacky, crazy kind of art furniture, but built the way I build guitars. So, I mean, it's like crazy high quality and really great materials. And I really enjoy it. I enjoy it a lot. I just haven't had time to do it for the last 10 years again.
That's really cool, man. I think that's really cool. I like it.
I didn't know that I would get back into building guitars, in all honesty. When I left Fender, I kind of had a bad taste in my mouth of it. And then I went and started the museum and did that for 4 years. And and so when I moved up here to Oregon, that's all I was going to do was my art furniture. And I did that for a couple of years before I got back into building, and then I got the passion back for guitars, and then I kind of lost the passion for the art furniture.
I really dig the cabinets. Those are cool.
Thanks. Yeah. So you're looking at it now.
I'm looking at it. Yeah, this is cool. This is like is that a bird's eye maple on that one?
I'm sure it is. My furniture used the same materials, like I said, with guitars.
Whoa.
I mean, I would make huge cabinets that with a bird's eye or quilted or a lot of the same influence.
This bird's eye, this bird's eye looks like it's gold leaf. That's how it's so tight. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's really something. Well, wow, John, I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk with us today. I appreciate it.
Well, absolutely, Mark. I appreciate you asking. It's been a hoot talking. And what more can I say? Thanks for all the support.
Oh, absolutely. Now and forever, man. You just keep doing what you're doing. And that's really cool to know that you're making the Lefty. So I'm going to go look into that because I think I want me a Lefty AJ. Lefty AJ is about right for me. Why not? I got 33 guitars. Why not 34, right? What's the big deal?
Hey, never enough.
Never enough. If you ask my wife, maybe she'll think of something different. But
yeah. Well, if I ever decide to sell that butthole guitar, I'll make sure I'll let you know.
I'm there. You say the word, I'm there. John, man, thanks so much for being on the show.
All right, Mark, take care, and take care of all your listeners out there, man.
I will, absolutely. Thanks so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Instagram, and Tumblr, and of course, on guitarradioshow.com.